Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Are you looking for a podcast about pro football that doesn't put you to sleep with an avalanche of analytics or insult your fandom with brainless hot takes? Well, hi. I'm Dan Hanzus.
And I'm Mark Sessler.
Oh, hi, Mark. And we're the hosts of Heed the Call, the NFL podcast you've been waiting your whole life for.
Heed the Call covers every game, every storyline, everything that matters, and we do it all with a touch of mirth.
Football is fun. Why shouldn't your football podcast be the same?
Follow and listen to Heed the Call NFL podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1919, he hit 29 home runs and was sold to the New York Yankees.
A three-run home run for Buffington. The Yankees now lead it by a score of 3-2. Bill Lee is now going over to a couple of the Yankees, and there they go again.
Bomb hits it to deep left. That might send the Yankees to the World Series.
Varitek and A-Rod going at it. Roberts is going. Posada's throw. Roberts, safe.
What can I say? Just dip my heart and call the Yankees my daddy.
And welcome to episode 59 of Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports, which morphed into really just an amazing baseball podcast, really, to be quite honest with you. John Senecal, Brian Jackman here with you, holiday edition. And actually, if you're watching us on YouTube, we got headsets on today because we have a guest and kind of a cool guest, for me at least, and I think for you when you get to hear from him a little bit. John, what's happening?
Not much. Getting into the home stretch of the holiday season here, Brian, and trying to deal with all the stuff with the kids and keeping them from bouncing off the walls and getting them to school on time and, the typical stuff that leads up to the big day.
Right. And then when we get past the big day into the new year, then we'll start to get a little nervous about pitchers and catchers reporting.
No baseball news at all. Tons of minor league crap, but nothing to be talked about, really.
Like, and not quiet in a good way either. And so our guest today, his name is Dominic Rivers. We call him Dom. And I first met Dom in the fall of 1988 on the campus of Phillips Exeter Academy, and where I transferred from Swampscott High School as a junior. And I lived in a dorm that wasn't really a dorm.
Was that a sports transfer, Brian? Were you there on a sports?
Well, I thought I was there for sports, but it didn't turn out that way.
No. Dom, was he an athlete back then? Was Brian an athlete back then?
No, he was, but he was a legitimate scholar, too.
Thank you.
He was a varsity hockey player. And did you make varsity in any other sports?
Well, I switched from tennis to lacrosse my junior year, and then in my senior year I decided to do a play, and I didn't play football. I focused on hockey, but the truth is, I came there thinking I was a big deal in hockey, and I left there knowing I wasn't.
But you played hockey and tennis. That's quite a difference.
Yeah, well, it was funny because at Swampscott High School, tennis wasn't that good, and I didn't want to play baseball, and I could play tennis. And, like, honestly, it was so fun coming off of hockey. I played doubles. But it was a totally different crowd, but I wasn't a good enough tennis player to play at Exeter. But anyway, we lived in a house with 13 guys in all.
13, yeah.
And Dom was, to be honest, in a dorm full of juniors, seniors, and PGs, almost all athletes, there was Dom. And I say that with respect, but he might actually have been the biggest sports fan out of everybody. So, first of all, Dominic Rivers, thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome. I enjoy your show. Thanks for inviting me.
So, I mean, the memory I have the most was, I think it was a pig. I don't think it was a bear. I think it was a pig with a Reds hat. It was this huge stuffed animal that he had in his bedroom. I'm not kidding. I mean, that's right. Was it a pig? What was it?
It was a stuffed animal pig about the size of
Marge shot.
The trunk of a Honda Accord, maybe, I mean, that big. And it was a stage prop. My parents work in the arts that I just got handed to me, and I threw a baseball hat on it. I don't know what I was thinking bringing it there, but I don't know. I guess I wanted to stand out some way. It wasn't going to be playing varsity hockey.
He snuggled with the big pig. And he's a Cincinnati Reds fan. And, just talk a little bit about you know, your life as a fan and how you, you know, where you came from, why you became a Reds fan, and how big a baseball fan you are, like, relative to the rest of the world.
Well, to put it in context, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and it's a big baseball town. So, I mean, I played Little League and whatnot, but I think the two biggest reasons I became a Cincinnati Reds fan and that I continue to follow baseball maybe more than the average person even there is two reasons. One, paternal grandparents, my dad's parents, and two, Marty Brenneman, the Reds announcer. So, I think even though I didn't have athletic talent, the love of baseball sort of skipped a generation. And my dad's just recently retired music professor and serious musician. And true story, he got his nose broken the first day of Little League. The ball hit him right in the nose, and the bug never took. So Reds games were something I listened to with my grandparents when I'd go over there. And even though he turned kind of into a cranky old man in his old age, I mean, Marty Brenneman was great on the radio. And there were days where, I don't know, maybe at age 10, 11, I probably caught 120 of 160 games on the radio or on TV with the radio on.
Wow. And and so you got it from your grandfather, and the announcer is what drew you in. And, you know, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, grandmother to some extent, too, both of them.
And so the Reds were, I mean, now they were great in the 70s, obviously, with the Big Red Machine. So, but you were probably 3 or 4 years old when they won that World Series, right?
You hit it right on the head. I was aware of names like Rose and Bench, and I would have gone in my first game that I honestly don't remember at a time when the Big Red Machine was playing, but the first season I really started to follow. I was seven, and most of the Big Red Machine was gone, but they were still a playoff team. That was the year of the Pirates and with the We Are Family and all that.
Yeah, 78.
World Series. So 79, yeah. So they beat the Reds in the NLCS that year. That still wasn't a bad time to catch on. Morgan was still there, and Bench was still there. They weren't as good as they were. Tom Seaver, you know, had come over in the trade. But then you're right. Most of my fandom was when the Reds were terrible. I think they went from a playoff team to a 60-102 or something like that in 1982. That's when I would have been 10. So yeah, it's for the I'm not really backing a winner, and so I was not. I wouldn't say I'd have the complex of the Red Sox fans because they didn't really lose in that dramatic of a fashion. They just were bad. But then by freshman year of college, they had that surprise world championship in 1990, and that's the last time the Reds won a championship.
Yeah, I mean, look at the playoff history. They won in 90, which I forgot about, and then they made it to the playoffs in 95, 2010, 2012, 2013, and 2020.
Well, they weren't supposed to win in 90. That was the year the A's were supposed to win back-to-back. Yeah. Championships, and they walked in there and smacked them around.
Yeah, they swept them. So that was the Bash Brothers? That was Canseco and McGuire?
Because I believe the Dodgers was 88, right? And then the A's were 89 with the Bash Brothers. That was the year of the earthquake against San Francisco.
Right.
And then 90, they were supposed to run away with it. I mean, the Reds didn't have a chance from what everyone was saying, I believe.
So that was the Rob Dibble and the Lou Piniella?
The Nasty Boys. Yeah, and John touched on a couple things there. I mean, I think there's a lot of similarity between the great Orioles teams of the late 60s, early 70s, and those A's teams of the late 80s. They got to the World Series 3 years in a row, and they both won just one.
Right.
And I met in the middle one in both cases, but it's they would have been considered a dynasty, like, you know, the 77, 78 Yankees and that sort of, you know, mini dynasty if they had maybe won two instead of three. The A's were good. I would say the Reds were better than their record. That was the year they started 8-0 and, you know, something like, you know, 15-3 or something. And they pretty much they were a wire-to-wire team. And they rested a lot of people, things like that. So they were better than people thought going in. But the A's had, McGuire had a low average year, but still had his power. Ricky was incredible, hitting I don't have it in front of me, but I assume around 30 homers. And
I think that was they had four consecutive Rookie of the Years. It was like Canseco, McGuire, Steinbach, Walt Weiss. I think was on that team. Like,
yeah, they
were a juggernaut. Yeah. Dave Stewart, I believe, was on that team. Pitching wise,
but if you look at the numbers, the Reds haven't won an actual playoff game.
Oh yeah, no.
Since 95, I believe.
Well, then they got no hit against Roy Halladay, didn't they?
What's that?
They won two in a series against the Giants, and they've not won a playoff series. They have won two games.
In 2012. I got it. Yeah, that's right.
That was one of those years that the Giants, I forget if they were a wild card or if they were a division winner, but it's amazing they won 3 in 5 years because the Reds had them, 2-0 going home.
Right.
The Reds, it was one of these weird years where it was going to be a 2-3 as opposed to a 2-2-1. And so the Reds went to San Francisco 1-2. Votto was hurt. He could only get singles.
Well, so they had three chances at home to close out that series and couldn't do it. That's amazing. It's funny when I look at this, I didn't even know the Reds made the playoffs that much in the last 20 years. I would have thought it would have been like once. I just have no memory even of 2020 for some reason. I don't know why, but it happened so fast. But listen, we're talking with Dominic Rivers here, and the real reason I wanted to have you on here on episode 59 of Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports, is that a couple of years after college, I think, and Dom, your memory is way better than mine, Dom asked me to join a rotisserie baseball league.
And what year was this?
This is like
2000.
Yeah, so fantasy sports had started but hadn't really exploded. It started to emerge because I started the Fantasy Focus radio show on ESPN Radio, but that wasn't until like 2004 or something.
You started playing with me in 2003 in that NBC league.
Right. Okay, so this predated that. And like, I had no bleeping clue what the hell Dom and his friends were talking about. Like, I mean, literally, like, I thought maybe, like, you punch in a couple numbers and you get this. Like, they're talking about crap that I'd never heard of. And then you have cards and these numbers. And, I mean, just, first of all, for people out there, what is rotisserie baseball? Is this all, like, the Bill James stuff? Or, like, I don't even understand it to this day.
Yeah, and it's good to go into that. I mean, rotisserie gets that name from if you go back to it might even be in the Ken Burns documentary, it was the name of a restaurant where they started the game, and it was the writer Donald O'Krent was part of it, and some other people that are somewhat have some notoriety. But rotisserie specifically, their style of play is it's not a point system. It's, if you're first in home runs, you get, and there's 10 guys in your league, you get 10 teams, you get 10 points. For second in RBIs, you get 9 points, et cetera. And so what we had, Brian, in 2000, and this league is still going. It's like 22 years later.
Jeez.
It was more of a fantasy league with really nerdy categories, right? So before, WAR hadn't come out yet, but, Bill James's RC27, runs created per 27 out, had come out. And this is how ridiculous. I mean, I wasn't even aware of the fact that some of the things we were coming up with, these sabermetricians had come up with already in a very similar form. So we've improved on it since then and kind of tossed our own categories for something that actually exists, at least in the uber baseball nerd community. But yeah, it's a rotisserie. It gets a little clunky. I think it's played a lot because that those are the categories that a lot of people started with, back in the day. But, if you think about it, if you have 5 categories for pitching and one of them is saves, then it's going to make closers more valuable than they are in the real world. And stolen bases in the offensive side, you're going to have, rabbits that can't get on base being very valuable. I think that was one of the reasons we wanted to do our own categories is we'd played rotisserie baseball a bit, and it just got tiresome to chase, this mediocre pitcher who might become the closer for the Padres and this guy who couldn't hit who might steal 30 bases. So that was more the impetus there.
I couldn't get my arms around it. I was just like guessing and hoping it worked out. I mean, it was nuts.
So I remember my friend, in high school, like in the 90s, early 90s, I graduated in 93, we would play. His father followed Bill James. It was that was like his thing. I guess he had
In the 90s.
Yeah, he had like a book out and all this stuff. Now he used to draft teams, and they would play in this league with friends all around the country. And this is like when email was just starting out, and a lot of it was just like weekly. They would have letters or a meeting. I don't even know how it worked, but they would literally track the stuff themselves. They would track it with the paper. They'd get the paper in the morning or whatever, you know, before you could go online and get all this stuff. And I couldn't believe it. It was, you know, basically it's exactly what is going on today through all these fantasy sports online things, but he was doing it with his hands and his friends, you know, around the country. And that was nuts. And they'd play for money, and it was, you want to talk about putting work in. Now that was crazy. Every day, but they'd go by week.
But in some ways it sounds like it was like traditional metrics.
Traditional. I mean, they would go and, you know, I don't remember all the categories and all that. But I just remember, you know, listening to him because, you know, he was really into it, super into it. His dad was an attorney for General Electric, and him and his buddies that they had met, you know, I think probably in college, you know. And
you still enjoy it, Dom? It's still fun?
It's funny you mentioned. I still do. I think the last couple of years, maybe the first one pre-pandemic, it's not as much of a distraction. You never want it to become work, and there's been more times where it's become work. I've thought about giving it up or taking a year break, but usually February rolls around. Like, all this draft, the draft is going to be so much fun. You know, can't wait to do it. So I still like it, but, you know, this year we actually, so the pandemic year, we decided not to bother with a 60-game season. I think a lot of leagues went the same way. But I still like it. But it was sort of the gateway drug into discovering Bill James, you know, John mentioned, and some other people who thought that way. And Moneyball came out in 2002.
Yeah.
And even before that, you know, a year or two, people in my leagues were really interested in what Billy Beane was talking about doing. I tried to become, you know, Theo Epstein before there was a Theo Epstein. I went to grad school for sports management, and I wrote. We had to write a paper on the next sports leader you think is going to be a big deal. And I picked Billy Beane. Moneyball hadn't come out, and the professor, some organizational behavior professor from the business school, like, never heard this guy. So right. You will. And sure enough, everybody did.
Well, this is what bothers me, and you can correct me, Dom. We're talking about Dom Rivers, a good old friend of mine from high school, who was the first guy I knew who knew baseball in the data-driven way, and I learned a lot from him, and he still, there's a lot of stuff I never understood that he was talking about. But I felt that you wanted to be in baseball, positioned your life to be in baseball, and couldn't get into baseball. And I've thought about you a lot in the sense that and this is personal and you don't have to share, but like, I feel like because you didn't go to Yale or you weren't a former player or weren't 6 feet, you know, 160 pounds, that I'm always a little sad and or a little frustrated that you didn't get a chance, because I think that you A, were ahead of the curve, but B, clearly have a passion and a talent for it. And I just was curious how you viewed your inability to get in.
I totally see how it could look that way from the outside, but I don't feel that way. Here's why. I actually did get more opportunities than the average person. So same grad program. There are a lot of major sports or baseball GMs have come through that program. And Ben Sherrington went through that program. You know,
right.
Pirates GM, and was the GM of one of the Red Sox World Series teams. Neil Huntington, the guy he replaced with the Pirates.
Yeah. Both Amherst College grads, by the way.
Pardon?
Both Amherst College graduates, by the way.
But both Amherst, right, that's right. Been with Amherst. I think he was backup catcher for the baseball team.
No, he was a pitcher, but a relief pitcher.
Okay. Yeah. So him, Chris Antonetti from the Indians. I was interviewing some people, and one of them was Ben Sherrington when he was scouting coordinator for the Red Sox, but another was Dave Littlefield when he was the Florida Marlins assistant GM, and we had a series of great conversations. And so, you know, I got an internship with the Pirates through him. I also worked for a lawyer who was outside counsel of the Red Sox. I did arbitration cases for 3 years, including one that went to a hearing. He was a middle reliever, you probably don't remember. But so I guess what I'm saying is I got more chances than some. I mean, my personal reason I'm really willing to share is, you know, I finished an internship, and the job offers I was getting was, you know, you can be this minor league coordinator. It's going to pay $21,000 a year. It'll be in the middle of Florida. You have, you know, and my wife at the time didn't thrive. She has vision impairments. We wanted to live somewhere urban. So life kind of got in the way. I really feel like I jumped ship before.
So you could have gone in you know, the bean burrito, eating a lot of garbage to make your way. You could have gone that route.
Exactly. Yeah, that's my point, is that I don't want to go out and say poor me, because, you know, the UMass program and that network and Dave Littlefield, you know, I know didn't turn out as a great GM. He's a good guy. He's a great scout. I think he's maybe with the Tigers now. I should look that up. But I had opportunities, and I chose family. I think, and I was also 30 or 31. You know, I was, you know, I had this music career that Shaq knows. I kind of jumped off. I gave that about 6 years, and, you know, now I'm a lawyer. So I think that it's definitely true that if you're 6'4" and super handsome, like you're saying, have an athletic background, you know, all that sort of thing can help. It also helps to be wealthy, and specifically what I mean by that is if you can do unpaid internships for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you really can make your way and impress people. I my parents were, you know, I had a great upbringing, you know, like music professors, things like that, middle class, upper middle class, but they weren't going to finance me. So I think the thing I take away from this is you don't need to feel sorry for me. And there are ways to get into baseball, and I was given more opportunities than most. I would also learn later that, you know, there's 30 baseball teams. I've never met any of the owners, but they don't seem like the greatest people to work for in general. And I learned later in life, it's very important to me who I work for, you know, going to law firms and, you know, that sort of thing. So I could have made those sacrifices and then realized I wasn't happy. And so you never know. It could have been a blessing in disguise.
Dom, you had mentioned something just a moment ago about working on a, you know, no-name middle reliever arbitration process. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that and, like, what that was like? Yeah, I mean, because, you know, obviously now that's kind of timely now, given the whole collective bargaining and stuff. I know it's not in the same scope, but I'm sure, you know, you just mentioned how the owners are probably not good to work for. I found that very interesting. Go talk a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Sure. No, and the player, Shaq, I remember his name was Rolando Arojo, who was a Cuban immigrant when there weren't tons of him. Really nice guy. He didn't speak English in the hearing, but everybody's, and this was kind of drilled into, you know, do not be too mean to this guy, because it's gonna come off as overly aggressive. But the process, I mean, I guess what can I tell you that people don't know? When you actually get to a hearing, it's maybe you know, a conference room with maybe 15 to 20 people on the player side of the table, 15 to 20 on the management side of the table, and or team side of the table, and three arbitrators down at the end. And you have, if I recall correctly, about hour and a half for one side of the case in chief, an hour and a half for the other side. Then there's rebuttals, and it's a mixture of lawyers and non-lawyers. But generally, the discourse is very simple. If you are, they're not going to hire Bill James to be on this panel. They're going to hire lawyers, judges, things like that, or professional arbitrators. And so I think my biggest takeaway was it was really, you know, it wasn't war or the equivalent of anything like that. It was, you know, Scott Hatterberg had the third best batting average of any catcher, so he needs to be paid like the Benito Santiago or something like this. Kind of ridiculous, intellectually dishonest arguments in my
I'm surprised by the numbers you're talking, though. I mean, you're talking about a middle reliever that really, I mean, nobody really remembers, right? He's still a major leaguer, but I'm counting like almost 35 people in this room to deal with this case.
Yeah, so it was. I think the player wanted $2.9 million, and the team was offering $2.2. So this was a, and that's still real money. That's like $700,000, $800,000. It's worth the price of the arbitrator's salaries and the consultants. I mean, you know, there are lawsuits out there for $100,000 all the time. But in terms of the good faith with the players and things like that, I agree with you, John. I get surprised when players and teams are $1 million apart and they can't settle. And I've learned since then, this wasn't the case with the Red Sox. They didn't have any, and this was Theo Red Sox, you know, Mike Cork was the GM, the interim guy, great, great guy in my interactions with him anyway. And there are some teams out there you might hear that always go to arbitration. If the player doesn't settle by this point, they're not going to settle, and they do it to make a point. I think that's relatively new, you know, that certain teams did that. I was there 3 years, and we went to one hearing. There were some that we flew down there, and it settled before we went in. The way they did it back then, it might still be the same. It would be 2 years in Florida, 1 year in Arizona. You know, maybe they flip flop that. There might be some old descriptions of the process in some of the Bill James books from the 90s, and I doubt the process has changed much. I saw some media report where in the current collective bargaining negotiations. I think the owners proposed using the WAR from the previous year or something like that, which just to determine salaries. And I don't know if that was a real thing or not, but my experience was every side really shied away from, you know, one category, whether you like it or not, to sum up everything, because, you know, the players don't want to be seen as a number, right? They've got their own characteristics and their own personality.
Right.
Until they want to get paid.
Right. The CBA, they want to get paid. And one of the five or six criteria is character or and health of the player and things. There's going to be those things like that. That even if it was interesting. It was a good foothold, and I thought that was it actually did help me stand out. You know, I sort of walked the carpet at the lobbies of the winter meetings 3 or 4 years in a row, and the fact that I had done any of that sort of stood out even from, you know, people in there that said, you know, hey, I was the star of my college baseball program,
right?
I work in baseball. Say, well, this guy's actually
done it.
So I got opportunities, and that was a fun one.
Listen, we're talking with Dom Rivers here on episode 59 of Fan Base, a deep dive in the greatest rivalry in sports. We're up against it in the clock. We only want to spend a few more minutes, but we have a couple things we have to get through. One is the issue that we talked about a couple of recent episodes is this whole sentiment, especially in some of the sports radio world, is that the data geeks, as they say in Boston radio, are killing the game of baseball. And you don't agree, so quickly give me we got to be tighter. Give me your disagreement.
Yeah, I think being against data, I mean, it's like being against knowledge. It just kind of rubs me the wrong way. It sounds very Pol Pot. Let's kill all the geeks, all the people with wearing glasses. What's happened, I think, is that smart people have seen some loopholes in baseball, and it's baseball's job to close them, right? So, in the NFL, in 25 years ago, the hurry-up offense was causing so much of a problem. You know, within a year, they made adjustments, you know, to the rule so that you couldn't do that in certain ways. You know, and with the NBA, you saw the change to the illegal defense because of the zone. I guess to be quick about it, if you don't like the fact that players are shifting, then ban the shift. It's so hard to move baseball, in large part because of the labor process, that there's a perception, perhaps a reality under labor law, that everything has to go through collective bargaining. So the way I look at it is, data is good. It makes teams make optimal decisions, and you don't be, you have to be frustrated when your team is doing dumb things. If it makes the game boring, then fix the game.
So, okay, so ban the shift. Fine with that.
I've come around on that, and specifically because you can ban the shift in different ways. With two infielders on each side of second base, the infielders in the infield, and the outfielders behind the infield, you know, in the outfield. I think that might make a difference.
Yeah, that does not seem like a hard thing to figure out, the banning the shift. I mean, it's baseball.
Why don't they do it then? Why don't they? And
maybe
why didn't they do
in the collective bargaining?
Why
agreement?
Did more players bunt when they had three guys in right field? Like, why not just why the stupid macho code? Like, lay down a freaking bunt.
Right.
I'd be interested to see how many.
That was my argument for not banning it. You know, why don't they learn to hit the other way? But you know, it's hard. You've got you've got everybody throwing 98 now, and then sliders that are 91. Maybe bunting's harder.
That's what I was going to say. I almost feel like, regardless of how talented these guys are, they're so programmed their whole life to hit a baseball that these balls are coming in such goofy things. It's almost harder to hit it when your bat's stationary.
It's fair. I wish I could agree with you, Dom, because I wish baseball could make changes. Like, they're still talking about a pitch clock. Like, to me, a pitch clock is so stupid because no one's ever going to pay attention to it. Like, to me, like, an easy fix is if you're throwing 20 warm-up tosses in the bullpen, why do you got to come out and throw 20 tosses on the stupid mound?
I think that's great. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like, it's so that you could save three because it's a commercial time or whatever. Like, why? Why do you have to have the stupid shortstop get five grounders before an inning? You know what I mean? The guy's a freaking pro. Like, these are easy fixes, but they don't want to shorten the commercial breaks because they can sell fewer ads.
Well, the commercial breaks is one thing, but you can work the pitching. I get. I mean, if you're in the bullpen warming up, you don't need those extra pitches.
You can save 15 minutes a game just by that.
Yeah, that is another easy fix. I mean, again, the pitch clock, nobody really pays attention to that unless somehow there's some like legit repercussions. But again, it's like, how do you enforce it? Look at the whole thing with the sticky substance thing. That became a joke by the midpoint of the season. It was like the umps weren't even looking for the stuff, and then they just go on about their business and start rubbing something else on afterwards, you know?
Right. And then again, do you think they were getting away with it again?
I would think so. It was almost like they didn't, like Brian and I talked about this before too, because, you know, they checked the glove and then they don't check it again. You could go out there, you have something in your pocket, or, you know, they're not checking everything. You know what I mean? They're not, there's so many different ways around it. And do you think those umpires really care? Do you think they really care?
I just know a couple of guys in the Astros looked like they were touching their hair quite a bit. But anyway, I don't know. I mean, this is a longer conversation for a different day, because I just feel like if baseball was more nimble, then I'd be on your side, Dom, but I don't think that they are. And to me, the game, and I love going to baseball games, but it's, I mean, 4-hour games at Fenway, as much as I like being there, it just gets to the point where it's not that fun.
No, it's way too long. 4 hours is too long for a baseball.
And so, all right, we're talking about Dom Rivers. A couple quick things here, and give me your answers. One, Joey Votto, in or out for the Hall of Fame?
Absolutely in. And if you're one of those people that think there should be only 8 first basemen in the Hall of Fame, then he's out, because I think there's only about 8 or 9 in the history of baseball that are better than he is.
Huh.
What about, while we're on the topic of Hall of Fame, because we go over this, we beat this horse to death. Bonds, Clemens, A-Rod. We'll just go with those three. What's your opinions? Yes or no?
My consistent opinion is put them in. But if you're consistently against PEDs, I can see, keep them out.
Yeah.
Okay. Reds, will they ever win a World Series again?
You know, absolutely. As long as they don't move to another city, I don't see that coming anytime soon. But you never know with small markets.
It seems like none of that. I don't know. So you think it'll happen again? That's good. I like optimism.
I like their stadium too.
You know, I don't mean to be too mathematical about it, but I mean, an average franchise should win one every 30 years. It's been like 31 years, and so it's not good, but it's also, you know, you can't go by Yankee Red Sox standards, or there's going to be a lot of disappointed fans.
I'm going to do $2 on the Reds to win the
World
Series.
Are they not spending any money? Are they not? What's the issue? Are they not spending money? I don't follow them closely enough to know what the issue is, because I feel like they got the fan base, they have money. Yep. Is it not hitting with the prospects, or
they have been very bad at selling low and buying high. You know, what they ended up getting with Rollis Chapman, in some ways that was bad luck because all the domestic abuse stuff came out right when it was time to trade him.
Yep.
But that happened in several places and making some signings that were bad from the beginning. I thought Mike Moustakas was a fun player, but a terrible idea. And a $65 million contract over 4 years doesn't matter that much to the Red Sox. That you know, that's a mistake with Panda that, you know, they can write off, but the Reds can't. So I think that they've been mismanaged somewhere in the middle of the pack below. You know, not the worst, but not the best. And also, penny wise, pound foolish. You know, if they had, you know, they were near first place for a playoff spot much of last year, and if they had maybe spent a little on decent bullpen arms, they would have had a better chance. But they're mediocre. And mediocre to below average, but not awful.
All right, Reds versus Red Sox, like uniform, team name, like who had it first? Like, I don't understand it.
Yeah, if you ask most people in Cincinnati, they'll say that the team that we have in the field is the oldest professional franchise. And that's not true. The first all-professional baseball team was the Cincinnati Red Stockings, I believe, 1869. There's natural connections to Boston and New York. Harry Wright started the team. He was born in England but grew up in New York City, and when he was around 30, he started this professional team in Cincinnati that were the Red Stockings, and they were undefeated for something like a year and a half. Then he became involved with the Boston club that took the Red Stockings name there, and the sports writers started calling them the Red Caps, but they went back to the Red Stockings name when they joined the American or National League, like in 1876. So there's that sort of three-city connection with Harry Wright going way back to the beginnings of professional baseball.
Nice. Hey, Dominic, you got some?
No, I'm just kind of blown away because I'm watching 1883 on Paramount Plus right now, and I'm surprised that they're actually playing baseball east of that as everyone's getting slaughtered and shot by Indians and they're killing each other.
Right. It was crazy that when you think about from like the Mountain Man era all the way through to 1900, how depending on where you were in America, your life was very, very different.
Crazy different.
Yeah, it's incredible. Dominic, you're the best, man. I love you. It's great to talk to you. This is the most we've talked. We talked maybe once, you know, twice in this stretch this much, so it's great to catch up.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. Great to chat. Great to meet you, John, and I'll keep listening to your show. Love it.
All right, thanks. Dominic Rivers from Colorado today here on episode 59 of Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. John, great job as usual.
Yeah, I think we probably next time we talk will be in the new year for episode 60, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we got some special treats too and a lot more guests.
Yeah, and unless something major happens, which I don't think Santa's bringing bargaining piece to the world this year.
We'll be dealing with labor. And also the Moonlight Graham of the Boston Red Sox will join us, which is going to be awesome. So have a great holiday, and we'll see you next year.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer.
SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait. There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino
and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.